Major Han, Rail 42. You were saying that you thought the Germans might have taken the civilian population of Camerino as hostage.
Yes.
Why did you think that? Do you remember why?
They were herded together.
Yes.
You see, which is unnecessary, I think, to do that to people. They should leave them in their own homes. And the whole sort of area seemed to be in flames, and the next morning we thought the enemy would have left, but no, they had no intention of vacating the area, and they were holding up our advance, and so trying to push on would have been quite costly.
What sort of place was it? Was it a town or a village?
It was a large village. Yes. Then, anyway, I don't know what it's like today. But it was on our line of advance. And this is the area where we first sort of met up with the enemy using this new tactic of laying in the hedgerows with a couple of bazookas and a few infantry, and shooting up our vehicles as we went along the main road, the road river.
Do you remember what happened to the civilian population? Did you evacuate them, or
they were left, and as we went on, they were freed, and there was no report of any atrocities at all.
Where were the enemy holding up? I mean, you said that as you approached Camerino, they withdrew, and they...
Well, we thought they... We didn't actually go into Camerino. We were on the outskirts, and we thought they would have withdrawn, but they didn't. They were still there the next day.
What, in the village?
In the village, or around the village, you know, sort of our line of advance. We don't know exactly what their positions were or how many there were. They could have been an infantry company or whatever. So would occupy the village and then gradually drop back.
And what had happened to the civilians then overnight? Had they stayed in the village, or had you got them?
No, we hadn't got them out at all.
You
we
hadn't?
Still in there.
Yeah.
It wasn't until the enemy withdrew that we found out what actually happened.
Where did they concentrate them? Were they, do you remember where they got them penned up?
I don't know. Mm. Probably in a large hall or barn or whatever. Yeah. I suppose they sort of keep them there so they couldn't get out and give information, perhaps. You know, that was, might have been the only reason.
Could have been a security measure.
Could have been.
Well, as it seems to me, that what you've been saying, the people welcomed you, seemed friendly, pro-ally.
Oh, they were very much. All the way through Italy, we found that they were very pro.
I mean, did they give you information often that was useful?
They'd tell you something, but they... I think the language barrier made it a bit difficult, and also they would only say, oh, they wouldn't realise and give information that would be valuable to us. They'd say, oh, yeah, the Germans were here, they speak here. And they might say there's a tank, or they might be, but they couldn't give you any information really that you could work on.
Because they hadn't had the training.
They hadn't had the training. They were just civilians. A soldier as a soldier, or a tank as a tank. But they, it was in this area where they started letting the armoured car go by and destroying the rear one, so that they got the two. They could deal with the first one that went by at a later time, or at their leisure. They know it couldn't get back and be going into the enemy. So
that's difficult to counter, isn't it, as a tactic?
Very difficult, really. What do? You go along, you think you're safe, and from up behind some bushes, it's too easy to camouflage yourself in, let the vehicle go by and then pop up. And from behind, and then on the 19th of June, two troop, which was commanded by Lieutenant Michael DePiro, and he was ambushed in that way. The leading scout car and Daimler armoured car, as obviously we had a scout car in advance then, followed by a Daimler armoured car. So, and they let the scout car go by. Let the same Rama car go by, and then got both of them. And again, fortunately, Corporal Smith and Trooper Tipton were reported missing, so they were in the scout car, so they were obviously taken prisoner. And Sergeant Jimmy Purvis, Trooper Hardy, and Trooper Meadows escaped. Now, Sergeant Jimmy Purvis was the second car, and Michael DePiero was in the car behind. Meadows was wounded, but they got away. So there's another case of the second vehicle.
The crew getting out.
The crew getting away without being... although one of them, Meadows, obviously I think probably might have been the driver, was wounded enough that they could get him out and rescue him. And that's what I'll say, that sort of tactic was going on now all along the street. It was delaying tactics, really, from the enemy point of view, and also a bit costly as far as we were concerned, certainly if it wasn't in crew, it was in material.
Well, if you're losing, you know, one of the crews of the two vehicles every time, that, again, that must have imposed a certain attrition.
That's right, yes. And I think we were the leading squadron then. I think there was always one squadron in reserve because the front, I think, was too narrow, and there were so few roads going up that way. You couldn't get three squadrons up.
So there's one squadron front.
One squadron front. There might have been another squadron off on a flank doing some other job, and there was always one squadron in reserve, sort of resting. But you needed the rest then because the day was very long. You start at 4, and you'd be on patrol till what, 10 o'clock at night because it was daylight, and you'd come back at 10 o'clock at night, and you'd have to replenish, feed,
and sleep,
and out at 4 o'clock the next morning. It was, everyone was really tired.
How many days then would you be the lead squadron before you went to something less demanding?
It could be a week. It depended on mainly, I think, casualties as well that dictated who would.
And you were saying earlier on that once in North Africa you got so exhausted that no one could stay awake, no matter how hard they tried, because you'd simply been patrolling for too long.
Yeah, you would be on, I think, one stage over a week, I think, especially as we were going back to LMA. We were absolutely exhausted with the whole squadron lined up, and they were all asleep, and I was running up and down trying to keep them awake, or one man awake on guard, especially the rear tanker, the armoured car.
Did you suffer from that kind of problem in Italy because of this relentless pressure?
Not so much, because you always came back at night for a few hours sleep, but before, in the desert, you were being cut off at night, so you had to get back otherwise. So there was no chance of sleep, and by the next morning you had to be in front again, and so it went on. But in Italy, certainly, you could come back and you could get a few hours sleep.
You were saying that casualties also had an impact. How did that work?
Sorry.
You said that casualties had an impact on who could, you know, who would be leading. And
You mean the squadrons?
Yes.
Well, if you suddenly lost, say, 4 armoured cars, you see, then there's 2 troops, so you're weakened. So then you would then put another squadron up, you see, with a full complement. And then you would then come back, you would then get another armoured cars, replacements, they were fairly quickly coming up. And you'd also have 1 or 2 spare crews in the echelon, so you could top up. The line of communication was not very long.
I was going to ask you about replacements, about whether you had to wait for new crews.
There'd be such a few hundred mile that they didn't have the replacements, but there, the line of communication is so small that they probably have one or two armoured cars back in the echelon, and they would come up for the crew. See, and then they would be topped up from just a way back.
So you, if you did suffer an ambush and lose a couple of vehicles, you could go back, reconstitute, and then...
That's right. So we, as I say, we lost the two armoured cars there, and later that day, up came C squadron and took over our positions, and we went back just north of Foligno to reorganise and rest. And
do you remember how long you had for that period of rest?
I think at least 3 or 4 days. Mm.
So you could then get some sleep.
You could get some sleep and feed and wash. And I know there's a large house just north of Foligno. And we put our armoured cars all amongst the trees. It's a big dry ground and more or less not quite parkland, but similar, but lots of cover. And we established our sort of bivouac in that area. And just after we got there, the owner of the house showed up, a woman, and she was very concerned. She couldn't find her son. He was about 16, 17 years old, and she was afraid for him because she hadn't seen him since the enemy left, and because they'd obviously occupied that area and the house as well. And she said she couldn't find her son, and so I organised the search of the whole grounds, and we found what we thought was a grave, as you could tell, you know, freshly ground, dug hole. And so we dug it up, and we found this young lad tied up with wire, his arms and legs tied behind him, and he was face down in this grave. So we lifted him out, and it was obviously he had been kicked in his stomach, you know, his whole body was kicked, and he died. You know, it was obviously just thrown into this hole. That was about the only atrocity we sort of come across. But it was so unnecessary to change. So why they did it, I don't know. It was very sad for the poor woman.
How did she take it?
Well, she was just... How would you take it? What do you do, you see, as a teenage son just destroyed by man? He might have been, you know, upset them somewhere or other. I don't know. He might have been something to do with the path stands, because there are path stands in that area. And that sort of thing.
Do you know what happened to, you know, to the... What happened to the body? Was it...
I don't know at all. We just sort of took it and left it with us. Yeah. And we couldn't do anything. And
had you had any contacts with partisans at all?
I think a little bit later. No, it was around Foligno that we first met up with them, because they had a sort of headquarters, which I went to later, just outside Foligno. So we could well have been sort of involved in that.
Perhaps they suspect him of spying or something of that sort.
But even so, to have done that to him, the young lad, is a sort of a little bit. If they'd have shot him, that'd have been a different matter, but to kick him to death. Terrible. And that was the time, as I say, the war to us then seemed to have taken on a new... we took a different view of it to what we had on the desert. With all the different tactics they were using.
And did this change your attitude to the Germans? Because I think earlier on your attitude to the Germans had not been particularly virulent.
We still had to. I put that down to the odd sort of people. Before then, I had tremendous respect for the Germans as fighting soldiers and that sort of thing. And you always get your rogues. And this could have been just one of the rogue sort of section of the enemy. But no, I still had the greatest respect for them as I thought very good soldiers. But we, as I said before, we were getting so tired by this, our casualties were higher, and the type of patrolling stretched your nerves so much you couldn't sort of relax. I mean, on the desert you could sit with your binoculars and look and see that, but you couldn't do that every time you move forward. You know, you were sort of expecting something all the time. You couldn't sort of say, oh well, this is going to be alright, because you didn't know what lay behind the corner.
You couldn't see far enough.
You couldn't. So it was quite a strain. And also, it wasn't just for a short day, it was a
long day.
Four in the morning till 10 at night. Being like that, you were really keyed out.
And another day, the same in prospect.
That's right. Well, as far as you could see ahead. And of course, for that time, most of the time, apart from when we had those rain jobs, it was boiling hot. You know, and you had looking all the time, you know, with the haze, sometimes with the heat haze as it was in Italy. You know, it was a tremendous strain. And not only were you tired through lack of sleep, you were tired because of the heat of the sun playing on you. If you're out in it all the time, it is very tiring, isn't it?
You get dehydrated.
Yes. Although we had no problem with water and supplies or anything like that.
So there was an improvement on the desert, wasn't there?
Oh, yeah, in terms of
food and also fresh water permanently
fresh water
available.
Yes. And of course, the lines of communication were so small. See, I mean, there we were sort of within a mile of the front line with our forward troops, HQ was from HQ. So we were right on there all the time. And as I say, the long summer days. And I've already told you about the fastening of a wire across the road.
Yes.
And a tank mine attached to it, so all that sort of thing. And on the 21st of June, Sea Squadron had taken over from us again. I didn't know when it was, they were still in the line from the last time, I think. And Sea Squadron troop was commanded by Lieutenant Bob Maguire, and they had obviously watched him go into Liga at night, because he had obviously leaguered, come back, leaguered as a troop, not come right back as a squadron. So he had leaguered in a field, or an area anyway, and he had obviously been seen by the enemy. And so he was attacked at night by a company of infantry. And of course they were all out of their armoured cars, sort of sleeping to the side of the wheels. And one man was on guard. And they were attacked. And Bob and Lance Corporal Moss managed to get inside one of the vehicles. And then they just blasted off with their guns, so HE, machine gun, you know, anything, just sort of kept shooting and shooting. And they apparently drove them off. And they had very heavy casualties. And at least 25 dead were laying around the armoured cars. And don't know how many were wounded. I think if you've got 25 dead, you can say you've got 25 wounded as well.
At least.
At least.
Normally, it's normally about 2-1, the ratio of wounded to killed, yes.
So, actually, and he had a very good day. Unfortunately, he had one chap killed, one of his men killed, and two wounded. But I think for what the damage he did was fantastic, really.
Was it a normal thing for a troop to leave on its own?
Oh yes, yes, that's the sort of thing you would do. But you would normally leave at dusk, come back. The other unfortunately, might not have seen him.
Yes,
he might have just come across him. Mm. But we always tried to make sure that certainly when we leave it, there'd be such a time when he couldn't be seen, and that wouldn't be anywhere. It was an obvious place. Just after the draw, I think. And so Bob got an MC for that. And then I got the report, Scott Needy got the report that an area north of Foligno, there was lots of landmines had been laid and was causing us problems. So I took Sergeant Jordan with a support troop. We spent quite a few hours neutralising them.
But was that for your own purposes or was it sort of more general effort?
As I was, we knew they were there and there would be a hazard coming up, so we dealt with them.
Do you remember what sort of mines they were? Were they anti-personnel or anti-vehicle or mixed minefield?
Depend on where it was, you know, and there'd be a landmine here and there, and so they sort of had to be checked and dealt with. That's really, I never liked dealing with mines myself. I always used to put a slab of gum cotton on and
blow it up
and come back, especially as the things were. In Italy, they're more likely people to be trapped. In the same area, something very unusual, really, there was an electric cable, you know, one of the high tension, they must have been still alive.
So power cable.
Power cable. And I found a civilian with his holding one. Well, that's still alive, and he was just there on the ground, and he was roasting, you know, just as though he was in an oven, and you couldn't do anything about it. He's just sort of jerking every now and again, and he was just cooking.
What happened to him? Do you know how he
obviously picked up this wire,
not realizing,
and of course, with it being a high tension thing, and he's had it, and as he was dead of it, you know. There was no place of sort of you could see he was living or anything, but even he was just roasting, which was a very nice sight, anyway. It's another case of poor civilians got it, as well as the military. It could have been anybody, probably might have touched it or stood on it. And the area around Camerino was being hotly contested, and enemy reinforcements of tanks and infantry were coming in. You know, they could be observed coming in, so they were strengthening that area altogether, so they must consider it quite a...
worth making a stand.
Yeah.
Was there any significant obstacle in front of Camerino, a river of any size or anything of that sort, to make it worth defending?
No, I think just beyond it was Gubbio, which was probably an important crossing. I think roads came from different directions, from Milan and that sort of thing.
Communication centre.
So I think that might have been the town that they wanted to secure. See, so that was just on the outskirts of it, a few miles from it. And by the 23rd, We were at full strength again, Beast One. We got our armour cars and the patient crews.
Where did they come from? Were they former members of the regiment who'd come back from?
They would come back from the echelon.
Mm.
How they got there, that'd be the echelon's job, the quartermaster. Mm.
But I mean, were these new boys, were they new to the regiment? Or
not necessarily,
they?
No. A lot of them would be from crews that had been knocked out.
Earlier on.
Come back, but they would still be, who had been with Beast Squadron. Or you might get the odd one who was fresh. But you would have one or two spare crews back in the echelon, and that would be those people. I don't think we really... I can't remember any new man, you know, coming straight in fresh to replace a crew that had been lost. I think a lot of them had been with the regiment or squadron for some time and had a little bit of experience.
So they fitted in all right?
Yes. A squadron, I don't know, I think they were all right. They'd been suffering casualties as well, and they had two armoured cars and a scout car destroyed in one day. With one killed and two wounded, this is all we got back over the radio. Exactly what happened, I don't know. Just a matter of you get these sort of things would come over the air on the rear link. The rear link would hear it being reported by the squadron, and if you happen to be around, they'd tell you.
Pass it on. Was the chain of reporting back the same as it had been in the desert in Italy?
Oh, yes.
Did you have the same system of...
Oh, yes. You would have it talk to the squadron leader. The squadron leader would then pass it by word of mouth to second in command, who was sort of next to him, more or less. And he'd then pass it back to regiment headquarters and so on.
So they'd go back.
Exactly the same.
Did you have any difficulty with operating the wireless sets in Italy because of the ground?
Because distance was so short. You know, I think had we had little long distances like we had on the desert, it might have been difficult. But we were always within a mile or two of the forward troop, and the IHQ was going to be a couple of miles back. I think that was when we went, the squadron might act on the flank, we had difficulty. And then you would send a vehicle halfway at a link.
Relay station.
That's right, yeah. I did that a couple of times, I think, with A squadron when we were up, and they were right over on the flank.
So I'd imagine that in Italy the weather, as well as the terrain, might diminish the range of a signal.
But as I say, we were so close that certainly within the squadron you wouldn't have a lot of problem. And when we did, we'd use a link. I think we said in the area of Sarra Valley and Camerino district. We were getting lots of problems because the enemy were much stronger in this area. And C Squadron were having a pretty rough time. On the 25th, Bob McGuire, who just had that business with his troop and accounted for a lot of enemy, he was ambushed. And they apparently again let his car go by. And he was hit by a rocket. His driver was killed. Bob was wounded and taken prisoner. And his gunner, Lance Corporal Moss, who again was in that thing, he escaped.
So he was the lucky one on that occasion.
He was the lucky one on that, but Bob was taken prisoner. The leading scout car had been allowed through the ambush and was next dealt with, and the commander of that and the driver were captured. See, so there was a case of four people lost, two vehicles lost on that one ambush. That was the trend all along through the house. And Bob remained prisoner throughout the